Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. From then-Senator John F. Kennedy, Profiles in Courage, and continuing with his essay on Other Men of Political Courage. In those troubled days before the Civil War, great courage in opposing sectional pressures, great perhaps even then of Webster, Benton, and Houston, was demonstrated by Senator Andrew Johnson of Tennessee, the bold if tactless fighter who in 1868 was saved from a humiliating ouster from the White House by the single vote of the hapless Senator Edmund Ross. As the Union began to crack in 1860, Benton and Houston were gone from the Senate floor, and only Andrew Johnson, alone among the Southerners, spoke for Union. When his train, as he returned home to Tennessee to fight to keep his state in the Union, stopped at Lynchburg, Virginia, an angry mob dragged the senator from his car, assaulted and abused him, and decided not to lynch him only at the last minute, with the rope already around his neck, when they agreed that hanging him was a privilege of his own neighbors in Tennessee. Throughout Tennessee, Johnson was hissed, hooted, and hanged in effigy. Confederate leaders were assured that his power is gone, and henceforth there will be nothing left but the stench of the traitor. Oblivious to the threat of death, Andrew Johnson toured the state, attempting in vain to stem the tide against secession, and finally becoming the only Southern senator who refused to secede with his state. On his return trip to Washington, greeted by an enthusiastic crowd at the station in Cincinnati, Johnson told them proudly, "I'm a citizen of the South and of the state of Tennessee, but I'm also a citizen of the United States." John Quincy Adams was not the only senator courageously to resign his seat on a matter of principle. When Andrew Jackson's personal and political popularity brought increased support for Senator Benton's long-pending measure to expunge from the Senate Journal the resolution censoring Jackson for his unauthorized actions against the Bank of the United States, Senator John Tyler of Virginia, convinced that mutilation of the Journal was unconstitutional and unworthy of the Senate, stood his ground. But the Virginia legislature, dominated by Jackson's friends and Tyler's foes, and influenced by the sentimental feeling that the president should be permitted to retire without this permanent blot on his record, instructed its senators to support the expunging resolution. Realizing that his departure from the Senate would give the Jacksonians greater strength on far more fundamental issues, and that his own political career, which already held promise of the vice presidential nomination, would be at least temporarily halted, John Tyler courageously followed his conscience and wrote the legislature these memorable words: "I cannot and will not permit myself to remain in the Senate for a moment beyond the time that the accredited organs of the people of Virginia shall instruct me that my services are no longer acceptable. But I dare not touch the Journal of the Senate. The Constitution forbids it. In the midst of all the agitations of party, I have there heretofore stood by that sacred instrument. The man of today gives place to the man of tomorrow, and the idols which one set worships, the next set destroys. The only object of my political worship shall be the Constitution of my country. I shall carry with me into retirement the principles which I brought with me into public life, and by the surrender of the high station to which I was called by the voice of the people of Virginia, I shall set an example to my children, which shall teach them to regard as nothing any position or office which must be attained or held at the sacrifice of honor." In one of the Senate's first outstanding demonstrations of political courage, the colorful and stormy Senator Humphrey Marshall of Kentucky chose in 1795 to end his career in the Senate by standing with the president in approving the immensely unpopular Jay Treaty with Great Britain. Although even the Federalists of Kentucky found it necessary to oppose President Washington on the issue, Marshall bluntly told his constituents, "In considering the objections to this treaty, I am frequently ready to exclaim, 'Ah, men of faction, friends of anarchy, enemies and willful perverters of the federal government, how noisy in clamor and abuse, how weak in reason and judgment appear all your arguments.'" touring the state in defense of his vote, Marshall was shunned and stoned. Late one night, a mob dragged him from his home with the avowed intention of dunking him in a nearby river. At the water's edge, United States Senator Marshall, with great calm and humor, told the raging mob, "My friends, all this is irregular. In the ordinance of immersion, as practiced in the good old Baptist church, it is the rule to require the candidate to relate his experience before his baptism is performed. Now, in accordance with established rules and precedents, I desire to give my experience before you. Proceed to my immersion." Both amused and awed, the gang of unruly townspeople, few of whom knew what the Jay Treaty was, though all were convinced that Marshall had committed treason by supporting it, placed the senator upon a stump and ordered him to explain his position. Beginning in the same humorous vein, the senator warmed to his work and concluded his speech by caustically blistering all of his enemies, including those who stood sheepishly before him and whom he later described as poor, ignorant beings who were collected on the bank of the river for the very honorable purpose of ducking me for giving an independent opinion. Among this patriotic group, old John Burns, the drunken butcher, was one of the most respectable. The freshman United States Senator from Kentucky was not immersed, but his sharp tongue could not prevent his involuntary retirement from the Senate. Acts of political courage have not, of course, been confined to the floor of the United States Senate. They have been performed with equal valor and vigor by congressmen, presidents, governors, and even private citizens with political ambitions. One or two examples of each are sufficient to show that neither the Senate nor Washington, D.C. has monopolized this quality. Many years prior to his election to the Senate, John C. Calhoun of South Carolina demonstrated his greatest courage while a member of the House of Representatives. When in 1816, Congress raised its own pay from $6 a day to $1,500 a year, an astounding wave of condemnation had suddenly engulfed the nation and members from all parties. Comparatively few members even dared to run for re-election. Clay narrowly avoided defeat only by the most intensive campaign of his career. John Calhoun's most faithful supporters urged the young congressman to issue a public statement promising to vote to repeal the bill if the voters would only forgive and re-elect him. But Calhoun, who once told a friend, "When I have made up my mind, it is not in the power of man to divert me," would not back down. Indeed, he suggested that perhaps $1,500 was too little. Returning to Congress, vindicated by the support he had received, despite the fact that most of his former colleagues from South Carolina had been defeated for re-election, Calhoun stood practically alone on the floor of the House as members, new and old, scrambled to denounce the bill, but not Calhoun, stating, "This House is at liberty to decide on this question according to the dictates of its best judgment. Are we bound in all cases to do what is popular? Have the people of this country snatched the power of deliberation from this body? Let the gentleman name the time and place at which the people assembled and deliberated on this question. Oh, no. They have no written, no verbal instructions. The law is unpopular, and they are bound to repeal it in opposition to their conscience and reason. If this be true, how are political errors, once prevalent, ever to be corrected?" The President of the United States is not subject to quite the same test of political courage as a senator. The President's constituency is not sectional. His losses in popularity with one group or section may be offset on the same issue by his gains from others, and his power and prestige normally command a greater political security than that afforded a United States senator. But one example indicates that even the President feels the pressures of constituent and special interests. President George Washington stood by the Jay Treaty with Great Britain to save our young nation from a war it could not survive, despite his knowledge that it would be immensely unpopular among a people ready to fight. Tom Paine told the President that he was treacherous in private friendship and a hypocrite in public. The world will be puzzled to decide whether you are an apostate or imposter, whether you have abandoned good principles, or whether you ever had any. With bitter expiration, Washington exclaimed, "I would rather be in my grave than in the presidency." And to Johnson he wrote, stating, "I am accused of being the enemy of America and subject to the influence of a foreign country, and every act of my administration is tortured in such exaggerated and indecent terms as could scarcely be applied to Nero, to a notorious defaulter, or even to a common pickpocket." But he stood firm. It is appropriate in this book on the Senate, in selecting one example from among those governors who have displayed political courage, to choose one whose brave deeds as governor prevented him from realizing his ambition to reach the Senate. After reviewing a tremendous stack of affidavits and court records, Governor John Peter Altgeld of Illinois was convinced that an unfair trial and insufficient evidence had convicted the three defendants not yet hanged of murder in Chicago's famous Haymarket Square bombing of 1886. Warned by Democratic leaders that he must forget these convicts if he still looked forward towards the Senate, Governor Altgeld replied, "No man's ambition has a right to stand in the way of performing a simple act of justice." And when asked by the Democratic state chairman if his 18,000-word pardon document was good policy, Altgeld thundered, "It is right." For his action, the governor was burned in effigy, excluded from customary ceremonies such as parades and commencements, and assaulted daily in the press with such epithets as anarchist, socialist, apologist for murder, and fomenter of lawlessness. Defeated for re-election in 1896, denied even the customary right to make a farewell address at his successor's inaugural, "Illinois has had enough of that anarchist," the new governor snorted, John Peter Altgeld returned to private life and a quiet death 6 years later. He became, in the title of Vachel Lindsay's famous poem, "The Eagle That Is Forgotten." "Sleep softly, eagle forgotten, under the stone. Time has its way with you there, and the clay has its own. Sleep on, O brave-hearted, O wise man, that kindled the flame. To live in mankind is far more than to live in a name. To live in mankind, far, far more than to live in a name." Charles Evan Hughes, in 1920, was neither a congressman nor a governor, but he was the most prominent lawyer in the country, a former governor, Supreme Court justice, and presidential nominee, and under active consideration for further public office. He was shortly to become Secretary of State and Chief Justice. But when five socialists, duly elected members of a legally recognized party, were arbitrarily denied their seats in the New York State Assembly, largely on the basis of their unpopular views, risked his standing and popularity to protest the action as a violation of the public's right to choose its own representatives. After a classic battle in the New York Bar Association, he succeeded in obtaining a special association committee, with himself as chairman, to defend the socialists, whose views he personally abhorred, before the legislature. Denied the right to appear in person, Hughes filed a brief insisting that if a majority can exclude the whole or a part of the minority because it deems the political views entertained by the minority hurtful, then free government is at an end. Hughes' arguments apparently had little effect on the New York legislature, which expelled the socialists and outlawed their party. But many believe that the distinguished voice of Charles Evan Hughes, nearly alone but never afraid, and the courageous votes by Governor Al Smith of that legislature's measures for controlling radicalism in the schools were determining factors in arousing the nation to its senses. To close our stories of American political courage, we do well to recall an act of courage which preceded the founding of this nation and which set a standard for all to follow. On the night of March 5, 1770, when an abusive and disorderly mob on State Street in Boston was rashly fired upon by British sentries, John Adams of Massachusetts was already a leader in the protests against British indifference to colonists' grievances. He was, moreover, a lawyer of standing in the community, a candidate for the general court at the next election. Thus, even had he not joined in the sense of shocked outrage which all of Boston greeted the Boston Massacre, he would nevertheless have profited by remaining silent. But this militant foe of the crown was asked to serve as counsel for the accused soldiers in the massacre, and did not even hesitate to accept. The case, he later noted in his autobiography, was one of the most exhausting and fatiguing cases I ever tried, hazarding a popularity very hardly earned and incurring popular suspicion and prejudices which are not yet worn out. Yet the man who would later be a bold president and father of an independent senator and president not only remained as counsel, but acquitted his clients of the murder charge, demonstrating to a packed courtroom that no evidence was at hand to show that the firing was malicious and without provocation, stating, "Whatever may be our wishes, our inclinations, or the dictates of our passions, they cannot alter the state of facts and evidence. The law will not bend to the uncertain wishes, imagination, and wanton tempers of men. Gentlemen of the jury, I am for the prisoners at the bar, and shall apologize for it only in the words of the Marquis Becerra," stating, "If I can be the instrument of preserving one life, his blessings and tears shall be sufficient consolation to me for the contempt of mankind." This ends Senator Kennedy's essay on Men of Political Courage and the beginning of his last essay in the book, The Meaning of Courage. This has been a book about courage and politics. Politics furnished situations, courage provided the theme. Courage, the universal virtue, is comprehended by us all. But these portraits of courage do not dispel the mysteries of politics. For not a single one of the men whose stories appear in the preceding pages offers a simple, clear-cut picture of motivation and accomplishment. In each of them, complexities, inconsistencies, and doubts arise to plague us. However detailed may have been our study of his life, each man remains something of an enigma. However clear the effect of his courage, the cause is shadowed by a veil which cannot be torn away. We may confidently state the reasons why, yet something always seems to elude us. We think we hold the answer in our hands, yet somehow it slips through our fingers. Motivation, as any psychiatrist will tell us, is always difficult to assess. It is particularly difficult to trace in the murky sea of politics. Those who abandon their state and section for the national interest, men like Daniel Webster and Sam Houston, whose ambitions for higher office could not be hidden, laid themselves open to the charge that they sought only to satisfy their ambition for the presidency. Those who broke with their party to fight for broader principles, men like John Quincy Adams and Edmund Ross, faced the accusation that they accepted office under one banner, yet deserted it in a moment of crisis for another. But in the particular events set forth in the preceding chapters, I am persuaded after long study of the record that the national interest, rather than private or political gain, furnished the basic motivation for the actions of those whose deeds are therein described in this book. This does not mean that many of them did not seek, though rarely with success, to wring advantage out of the difficult course they had adopted. For as politicians, and it is surely no disparagement to term all of them as politicians, they were clearly justified in doing so. Of course, the acts of courage described in this book would be more inspiring and would shine more with the traditional luster of hero worship if we assumed that each man forgot wholly about himself in his dedication to higher principles. But it may be that President John Adams, surely as disinterested as well as wise a public servant as we ever had, came much nearer to the truth when he wrote in his Defense of the Constitution of the United States, "It is not true, in fact, that any people ever existed who loved the public better than themselves." If this be true, what then caused the statesmen mentioned in the preceding pages in this book to act as they did? It was not because they loved the public better than themselves. On the contrary, it was precisely because they did love themselves, because each one's need to maintain his own respect for himself was more important to him than his popularity with others, because his desire to win or maintain a reputation for integrity and courage was stronger than his desire to maintain his office, because his conscience, his personal standard of ethics, his integrity or morality, call it what you will, was stronger than the pressures of public disapproval, because his faith that his course was the best one and would ultimately be vindicated outweighed his fear of public reprisal. although the public good was the indirect beneficiary of his sacrifice. It was not that vague and general concept, but one or a combination of those pressures of self-love that pushed him along the course of action that resulted in the slings and arrows previously described. It is when the politician loves neither the public good nor himself, or when his love for himself is limited and is satisfied by the trappings of office, that the public interest is badly served. And it is when his regard for himself is so high that his own self-respect demands he follow the path of courage and conscience that all benefit. It is then that his belief in the rightness of his own course enables him to say, with John C. Calhoun, "I never knew what South Carolina thinks of a measure. I never consult her. I act to the best of my judgment and according to my conscience. If South Carolina approves, well and good. If she does not and wishes anyone to take my place, I am ready to vacate. We are even." This is not to say that courageous politicians and the principles for which they speak out are always right. John Quincy Adams, it said, should have realized that the embargo would ruin New England, but hardly irritate the British. Daniel Webster, according to his critics, fruitlessly appeased the slavery forces. Thomas Hart Benton was unyielding and pompous egocentric. Sam Houston was cunning, changeable, and unreliable. Edmund Ross, in the eyes of some, voted to uphold a man who had defied the Constitution and defied the Congress. Lucius Lamar failed to understand why the evils of planned inflation are sometimes preferable to the tragedies of uncontrolled depression. Norris and Taft, it is argued, were motivated more by blind isolationism than constitutional principles. All this has been said and more. Each of us can decide for himself the merits of the courses for which these men fought. But is it necessary to decide this question in order to admire their courage? Must men conscientiously risk their careers only for principles which hindsight declares to be correct, in order for posterity to honor them for their valor? I think not. Surely in the United States of America, where brother once fought against brother, we did not judge a man's bravery under fire by examining the banner under which he fought. I make no claim that all those who stake their careers to speak their minds are right. Indeed, it is clear that Daniel Webster, Thomas Hart Benton, and Sam Houston could not all have been right on the Compromise of 1850, for each of them, in pursuit of the same objective of preserving the Union, held wholly different views on that one omnibus measure. Lucius Lamar, in refusing to resign his seat when he had violated the instructions of his state legislature, demonstrated courage in totally opposite fashion from John Tyler, who ended his career in the Senate because he believed such instructions binding. Tyler, on the other hand, despised Adams, and Adams was disgusted with the envious temper, the ravenous ambition, and the rotten heart of Daniel Webster. Republicans Norris and Taft could not see eye to eye, and neither could Democrats Calhoun and Benton. These men were not all on one side. They were not all right, or all conservatives, or all liberals. Some of them may have been representing the actual sentiments of the silent majority of their constituents in opposition to the screams of a vocal minority. But most of them are not. Some of them may have been actually advancing the long-range interests of their states in opposition to the short-sighted and narrow prejudices of their constituents, but some of them were not. Some of them may have been pure and generous and kind and noble throughout their careers, in the best traditions of the American hero, but most of them were not. Norris, the unyielding, bitter ender, Adams, the irritating upstart, Webster, the businessman's beneficiary, Benton, the bombastic bully, of such stuff are our real-life political heroes made. Some demonstrated courage through their unyielding devotion to absolute principle. Others demonstrated courage through their acceptance of compromise, through their advocacy of conciliation, through their willingness to replace conflict with cooperation. Surely their courage was of equal quality, though of different caliber. For the American system of government would not function if every man in a position of responsibility approached each problem, as John Quincy Adams did, as a problem in higher mathematics, with but a limited regard for sectional needs and human shortcomings. Most of them, despite their differences, held much in common: the breathtaking talents of the orator, the brilliance of the scholar, the breadth of the man above party and section, and above all, a deep-seated belief in themselves, their integrity, and the righteousness of their cause. This book is not intended to disparage democratic government and popular rule. The examples of constituent passions unfairly condemning a man of principle are not unanswerable arguments against permitting the widest participation in the electoral process. The stories of men who accomplish good in the face of cruel calamities from the public are not final proof that we should at all times ignore the feelings of the voters on national issues. For as Winston Churchill has said, democracy is the worst form of government, except all those other forms that have been tried from time to time. We can improve our democratic processes, we can enlighten our understanding of its problems, and we can increase our respect for those men of integrity who find it necessary from time to time to act contrary to public opinion. But we cannot solve the problems of legislative independence and responsibility by abolishing or curtailing the democracy. For democracy means much more than popular government and majority rule, much more than a system of political techniques to flatter or deceive powerful blocks of voters. A democracy that has no George Norris to point to, no monument of individual conscience in a sea of popular rule, is not worthy to bear the name. The true democracy, living and growing and inspiring, puts its faith in the people, faith that the people will not simply elect men who will represent their views ably and faithfully, but also elect men who will exercise their conscientious judgment, faith that the people will not condemn those whose devotion to principle leads them to unpopular courses, but will reward courage, respect honor, and ultimately respect right. This concludes reading from John F. Kennedy's essay, The Meaning of Courage. It also concludes the readings of Profile in Courage by John F. Kennedy. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona,